Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 409. I am your host, Rachel, and I am recording from my home base in Boise, Idaho. We are recording this on January 23rd, 2022. This week, we're talking about the 20th century American journalist and spy for India, the Soviet Union, and Communist China, Agnes Smedley. Smedley, born in Missouri in 1892, grew up in a mining family during the Colorado Labor Wars of 1903 and 1904. The Colorado Labor Wars were a series of strikes conducted by the Western Federation of Miners under the leadership of Big Bill Haywood, who we've talked about before. These strikes were met with great violence by the mine owners, who hired detective agencies such as the Pinkertons, Baldwin Felts, and Teal agencies. And we've talked about both the Pinkertons and the Baldwin Felts agencies previously. The state government also sided with the mine owners, sending the National Guard to end strikes. The WFM countered with violence of their own, leading to one of the most violent periods in American labor history. So she had a very tumultuous, violent, deprived childhood. When Smedley was 19, she went to a teacher training college in Arizona, where she was introduced to socialist activists who brought her to San Francisco, and from there she made her way to New York, where she got involved in the movement for contraceptive access alongside figures such as Margaret Sanger. In 1914, when Smedley was 22, World War I broke out, although the U.S. did not join until 1917. She became, or was already before the war, involved in an interesting angle of activism in the United States against the Allied war effort, which doesn't receive much attention these days relative to German and Irish activism and American draft resistance. She joined U.S.-based activists in the Indian independence movement against the British Empire, financed by the German Empire's spy networks, to disrupt British military and economic power by forcing them to shift attention away from the European front. This was known as the Hindu-German Conspiracy. Smedley coordinated news media agitation content for the Indian independence movement in the U.S., including while some of their leaders were hiding in Mexico, as the U.S. authorities started cracking down on these efforts. This activism brought attention from both U.S. and British intelligence. Smedley was finally arrested by U.S. Navy intelligence for her activities in the spring of 1918, but charges were dropped after the end of the war later that year. Smedley went into self-imposed exile in the new German Republic, linking up with Indian communists and nationalists of various religious and ethnic identities based in Germany. These figures were either already prominent in the movement or would become prominent later. She remained in Germany for almost a decade before publishing a popular autobiographical novel entitled Daughter of Earth. Smedley then moved to Shanghai to work as a foreign correspondent for the famous liberal German newspaper Frankfurter Zeitung for a couple of years. Later, she would also work for The Guardian and ended up staying in China for over a decade. Smedley was involved until around 1936 with Soviet espionage activities in China and Japan. She provided foreign audiences with the narrative on the Communist Long March of 1934, although she was not a participant. She reported on the growing conflict with Japan and the military responses of the various Chinese factions vying for power, eventually traveling with two of the Communist armies participating in the United Front National Liberation Campaigns against Japan. In 1941, Smedley returned to the United States, and specifically to the nation's capital, to promote the interests of Chinese communists, specifically, but also broadly the United Front against Japan during the war. She spent the rest of the 1940s, mostly in upstate New York, under military and FBI surveillance, with growing pressure as the second Red Scare got underway. In particular, General Douglas MacArthur, who was obsessed with Red China, wanted to take her down. She once again exiled herself in 1949, this time to the UK, where she died the following year at age 58, having lived to see the final victory of the Red Army in mainland China. All told, including one posthumous work, she published 6 books, including her novel, collections of essays and news articles, and long-form nonfiction on the Chinese Red Army. These books were often critical in promoting understanding of the Chinese communists to outsiders. And this overview of Smedley's life largely came from the Wikipedia article on her, and also the Wikipedia article on the Colorado labor wars. As always, all our sources will be linked in the show notes to this episode. So for some other perspectives on Smedley, we found a few other sources. There's a Britannica article on her, which pretty amusingly contends repeatedly that she was not a spy or intelligence asset and was always an innocent player caught up in bigger plots she was unaware of, kind of an unwitting asset. And from this Britannica article, from 1919 to 1928, she lived in Berlin with the Indian nationalist leader Virendranath Chattopadhyaya, also known as Chatto. She taught English at the University of Berlin, did graduate work in Asian studies there, wrote articles for several periodicals, and helped establish Germany's first public birth control clinic. She began psychoanalysis in an attempt to combat depression caused by her rather traumatic childhood, and as a form of therapy, she began writing the autobiographical novel Daughter of Earth, which was published in 1929. And the Wikipedia article implies she had been seeking treatment for depression for nearly 20 years. In 1936, she began a journey to reach communist-controlled northern China. So she was in Xi'an in December 1936 and made English-language broadcasts on the brief capture of Chiang Kai-shek by rebellious Manchurian troops. Early in 1937, she reached Mao Zedong's headquarters in Yan'an. She underwent great hardships to travel with the 8th Route Army, also known as the Red Army, during the Sino-Japanese War, and in 1938 published China Fights Back, an American woman with the 8th Route Army, on her experiences in Shaanxi province. In Hankou, she worked with the Chinese Red Cross Medical Corps, collected supplies for the Red Army, and served as a publicist for the communists until the city fell in 1938. She then traveled through central China with the new 4th Army, a communist guerrilla force in Japanese-controlled areas, filing reports from time to time with the Manchester Guardian. And Smedley's ashes were interred in the National Revolutionary Martyrs Memorial Park in Beijing. Also, 3 of her personal letters are in the Duke University Library's archive. And one of them is a sweeping personal attack and denunciation of a fellow American who had been in Shanghai around the same time, but had instead, apparently, supported and fraternized with the occupying Japanese during the war, and afterward became an ardent propagandist against the Chinese communists upon her return to the U.S. Smedley kind of accused her fellow countrymen for kind of sleeping her way through Shanghai and then professing her repentance to the Japanese and then joining the Japanese against the Chinese after her capture by the Japanese. Also, the PBS program Nova did an overview on Agnes Smedley's life. It's kind of more of a salacious perspective on her life, kind of pointing out her spy activities and her romantic connections throughout her life. But it doesn't really offer any hard citations to primary sources, and some basic details like what year she died seem a little bit off. But there was, as I said, a pretty big discussion of her espionage activities beginning at NYU and UC Berkeley, and a photo of Chinese communists holding a banner reading, "Welcome, Miss Agnes Smedley, our great friend." So from that Nova feature. At New York University circa 1912, Smedley befriended a group of students from India who were agitators in their country's nationalist movement. She soon joined the Friends of Freedom for India, a secretive organization closely monitored by the U.S. government. Smedley offered to hide the group's codes, contact information, and correspondence in a room to keep their activities from possible government detection. Though Smedley eventually moved away from New York, the Indian nationalist cause remained close to her heart. In 1918, while she was a student at the University of California, Smedley was arrested in the company of Satendranath Ghose, a prominent Indian nationalist, and charged with aiding and abetting espionage. She was indicted for fraud on charges of having helped the Friends of Freedom for India establish themselves in the U.S. as a legitimate government in exile, but she was never tried. Soon after the indictment, Smedley left the U.S. for Berlin. She became involved with the communist faction of the Indian nationalist movement in Germany and entered into a common law marriage with Virendranath Chattopadhyaya, a communist Indian nationalist leader. During their relationship, Smedley traveled frequently between Moscow and Berlin under the aliases Mrs. Petroikas and Alice Bird, presumably to pass information between Soviet authorities and the Communist Party, to which she belonged. In 1928, Smedley left for Shanghai, China, by way of Moscow. Agents there assigned her to keep tabs on the British-trained and British-directed police in Shanghai and to support the communist cause there. Smedley began a professional and romantic relationship with Richard Sorge, a Russian-born spy for the Soviets based in Shanghai. Through Japanese and German contacts Smedley provided, Sorge collected detailed information on Japanese and German military intentions and capabilities. Before Sorge was executed in Tokyo for espionage in 1944, he wrote that his espionage activities were made possible only with Smedley's assistance. He referred to her, however, by a code name. During World War II, Smedley lived intermittently in the U.S. and served as an advisor to the U.S. General Joseph Stilwell, who was the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of non-communist China. Smedley used her position to recommend that Stilwell secretly send a limited amount of U.S. military supplies to the Chinese communists in the event that they could help the U.S. against a potential Japanese attack. Stilwell agreed to Smedley's request. For a different perspective, not a Western perspective, there was an April 2021 article on Smedley from the Chinese Communist Party's Global Times tabloid, which represents a Chinese nationalist perspective within the party, not to be confused with Nationalist China in Taiwan. The item was published, along with a 6-minute video featuring photos, newsreels, and reenactments, as part of a centennial series on 100 foreign figures who helped deliver the success of the Chinese Communist Party from 1921 onward. And a link to that will be provided in the show notes. So from this tabloid article, Miss Smedley felt at home in Yan'an with the 8th Route Army of the CCP. She was quite popular, staying with officials and soldiers in a Red Army uniform at daytime, and teaching soldiers to dance to phonograph music at night. She was eager to contribute to the Chinese Revolution. She wrote letters to invite foreign editors and journalists to Yan'an, and facilitated interviews with Mao Zedong by foreigners, including Owen Lattimore, editor of U.S. journal Pacific Affairs. Such interviews further broke the media blockade against the Red Army. She also wrote joint letters with Mao Zedong to U.S. President Roosevelt and with Zhu Dai to President of the Indian National Congress Nehru, asking them to send medical workers to China. As a result, renowned physicians such as Norman Bethune and Dwarkanath Katniss made their way to China. So this brings us to kind of a discussion section. I find it really interesting how the Western media, in particular the Britannica article and the Nova feature, both diminish Smedley and her achievements, but kind of from opposite viewpoints. So the Britannica article made it seem like Smedley naively happened to get involved in clandestine activities, like, for example, the Hindu-German conspiracy or Russian intelligence gathering, while the Nova feature kind of paints her as a woman who used her connections, her way of getting involved with prominent people and her romantic connections to become a prodigious lady spy, and kind of using her feminine wiles to extract information and convey it to spy networks. It seems like the CCP tabloid really seemed to give her the most fair and even-handed portrayal. Another point is, it seems like her mental illness is kind of used as like kind of a reason for why she did what she did. But I really don't think that really had a big impact on her activities. She did suffer from depression and it did lead her to write her first book. But I don't think it like forced her to act a certain way, which is what it seemed like the Wikipedia article kind of hinted at, that her mental illness kind of caused her to play up her feminine wiles to get her way and to make these connections and help in her like spy activities. Another thing that kind of got papered over is like her birth control efforts and her efforts kind of in that contraceptive movement. It really got downplayed, as well as her efforts in the Indian nationalist movement kind of really got downplayed in favor of her Chinese coverage, her reportage. What it seemed like those activities really did have a big impact on her life. The birth control movement, the contraceptive movement, really led her to meet like these socialist activists in the 1910s and 1920s, which really set her on the path to joining up with the Chinese Communist Party and being able to write about them so well. So I think it's kind of a disservice to her to downplay those earlier movements and really focus just on like the Chinese and Russian activities. I had never heard of her prior to learning about her just a few weeks ago. And I think that's really a disservice because she really was a pretty important figure in these times. It seems like the Chinese media seems to really paint her in the best light and really focus on her achievements in the best way, in a way that the Western media just doesn't. It seems like they're really trying to downplay her prominence and her role in these movements. Bill, did you want to say anything?
Yes, I'm also here. No, I agree with a lot of the points that you've just made. I was actually kind of surprised about the extent to which the birth control movement aspect was downplayed. I agree with you as well about the issue of the mental health stuff. I mean, it may be that she got involved with some of this stuff because it felt to her like it was giving her a purpose in life. And I think that was kind of, you know, there's thematic elements there with the title of that book that she wrote, the autobiographical novel, Daughter of Earth, this idea that you have an obligation to, you know, liberate the earth and so forth. And as you said, she is like very sort of highly elevated within the historiography of the Chinese Communist Party itself, like its own history of itself in terms of her role and being this pivotal outsider that, you know, really believed in them and had that. She had this line that she supposedly said, which they quote all the time, about how the army, referring to the Red Army, was the hope of China and all of Asia. And, you know, because of the way that things played out and that they were, in fact, successful, they are able to sort of make her look like this, you know, prophetess, you know, of predicting the future. That was kind of an interesting perspective. I've also done a little bit of looking around, not as much, to see, you know, is there a, sort of a similar perspective on her with regard to the Indian side of things, right? That, you know, as you said, and I agree, the emphasis tends to be, and this is partly because of what she spent most of her career doing and most of her writing on, tends to be on the Chinese aspect. But then the question is, how did the Indian nationalists and Indian independence activists and communists view her? That was a little bit harder to find, I found, which I suppose is one potential answer to that question, but also may just reflect the sort of decline of Google searchability, which is something that other people have commented on a lot. I did find there was an article in some publication, and I have no idea even what this publication is, but this one was headlined Red Shadow Behind Subhas Chandra Bose, and she is mentioned there. This is in openthemagazine.com. Again, it's, I don't really know what the provenance of that or alignment of that particular publication is, but this is kind of looking at some of the intelligence files involved in some, in this case, British files and so forth, but various other countries' intelligence files. As usual, a lot of this stuff didn't get declassified until after the Cold War, especially if you're talking about the NKVD or KGB type files. And they do mention in this article about which people were introduced to Agnes Smedley, usually via that guy that was referred to as Chatto in Berlin and so forth. And this article just flat out asserts that she was an agent of one of the Soviet intelligence agencies. They don't play around with this idea that the Britannica article had that was, oh, you know, she wasn't really involved with it. And it was just, you know, she was just this unwitting dupe and so forth. This article also asserts that Nehru himself was acquainted with Agnes Smedley, which I had not seen mentioned in any of the other things that we had read for this article. But I want to emphasize as well that, as with this article, this is consistent with all the other articles, which is that there's a lot of disagreement as to what exactly the involvement is. What was she doing at various points? A lot of these articles disagree with each other, and I think that is telling in its own right, that some of this is sort of shadowy, right? And we maybe are never going to fully know some of the extent of her activities. Another point that I wanted to make, and I was curious what your thoughts were on this specifically, Rachel, was the aspect of being a journalist in this era as a propagandist, right? And this is far from an exception, right? This is the rule, in fact, is that at the time, a lot of journalists, their role was explicitly to provide a particular propaganda angle. Now, some of this, she was writing for mainline liberal newspapers and things like that. But in some cases, she was working for, you know, movement newspapers and so forth. But we know that there were a lot of these journalists, especially reporting on the Soviet Union and so forth, who were very open about their perspective, that they were sympathetic with the people that they were reporting on, that they were there to get out this message that wasn't otherwise being heard. And it's very distinct from the journalism that we see today, where there's supposedly this neutral, objective, centrist perspective, which is, of course, itself inherently ideological, but it supposedly is trying to just bring you the facts and, you know, that kind of thing. And that contrasts with this era of activist journalism, where you would go and say, look, this is my perspective. This is something that I'm bringing to you. You can decide whether you believe it or not. That's completely up to you. But you should be aware that this is a perspective that's out there, because otherwise you're just not hearing that perspective. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that, because that to me seemed like an interesting feature of her career.
Yeah, I think it just seems more honest, because I think there's kind of this like neutrality, this veneer of neutrality or veneer of objectivity that is obviously biased because just the inherent nature of somebody's writing a certain piece, and they have a perspective that they're bringing into it. So the fact that they were openly stating their sympathies with the Communist Party of China or whatever, like, it just seems more honest and just able to bring the message to more people that wouldn't necessarily be exposed to that sort of information. Like, how many Americans were reading about the Eighth Army from an embedded reporter at that time? So she was able to offer a really unique message, a really unique perspective, that I think is, like I said, just more honest. Also, I wanted to point out on that same kind of wavelength, Smedley did have a relationship with Ozaki Hatsumi, who was a Japanese correspondent for the Asahi Shimbun, and he also traveled from Japan to China, and he was like really surprised to find that China was looking to expel the Japanese from China and were not really happy to have Japanese people in China and wanted to expel them. So he was exposed to a different perspective, and then he became also kind of a propagandist for the Communist Party in China, writing for the Japanese press, and kind of got involved in intelligence gathering that way. And he became involved through Smedley with Richard Sorge, the Soviet spy, and actually became a spy for Russia, passing them information about Japan's like military capabilities and movements. So it was very interesting how he kind of also got brought into that world along with Smedley and through Smedley.
Yeah, and I think that is a testament as well to her sort of very deep-seated internationalism. Again, going back to that title, Daughter of Earth, that she just believed very firmly that you couldn't do things alone, one country, you know, by itself. It all had to be viewed within this global lens, that all of these forces were not separate from each other. They were all interacting with each other. There's a quote that I found in another Indian-oriented article that I was looking at, which quotes from that sort of fictionalized autobiography, talking about Lajpat Rai, one of the activists that she had met at when she was in New York during World War I. This was around the time that the U.S. was entering the war. And she wrote, "He introduced me to the movement for the freedom of his people and showed me that it was not only an historic movement of itself, but it was part of an international struggle for emancipation." And that, I think, really sort of illustrates from quite an early point, but, you know, of course, she's writing this in, you know, quite a while later at the end of the 1920s. This illustrates the sort of the way that she was living her life and how she saw all these aspects of world history that were unfolding in her own time. I also wanted to talk to that end specifically about something that we glossed over a little bit in your overview, but I think is worth circling back around on. So obviously, as we said, some of the U.S. military, from the U.S. Naval Intelligence during World War I to Douglas MacArthur after World War II, were never psyched about Agnes Smedley. It was a huge thorn in their side to have this loud American woman who had popular audiences all over the world reporting all this pro-communist stuff. Although it's important to emphasize that there was a period in World War II where the United States had all kinds of journalists from, you know, these are mainstream journalists from major outlets reporting pro-communist content from around the world, whether it was pro-Vietnamese insurgency against the Japanese, whether it was the Chinese communists against the Japanese, whether it was the Soviets against the Nazis. There was a whole flourishing of where it was acceptable and, in fact, encouraged by the U.S. government to talk about how the true Democrats in the struggle for global freedom against Hitlerism and so forth were these, you know, and other fascist movements were communists, right? That they were like the Americans. And in many cases, this was reflected as well on the communist propaganda side. Certainly, we know that people like Mao and Ho Chi Minh definitely tried to pump out a lot of stuff to appeal to specifically to American decision makers, you know, and it, you can question how much they necessarily believed it, but that this was the continuation of Abraham Lincoln's movement and Jeffersonian ideals of the Declaration of Independence, things like that, right? There was this big push to say, yes, we're all fighting for true democracy and so forth. But there was one general, as Rachel said earlier, who did seem to have a pretty positive relationship with Agnes Smedley during this whole period, even though she was mostly not in China at the time. She did bounce back and forth a few times, I think, during the war, which is itself kind of unusual. She was working with the top U.S. general inside China. This is General Joseph Stilwell. He was the senior military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, who was ostensibly the, you know, the nationalist Chinese leader. But China had been really fragmented before the war, and everyone kind of agreed temporarily to put this on hold, have another united front, and they agreed to let Chiang Kai-shek be the top guy. Nobody was really happy about this arrangement, and we, you know, we certainly know this because one of the people that had covered the sort of internal debate on this was Agnes Smedley. She had covered the kidnapping where left-wing or left-wing sympathetic, at least, soldiers had kidnapped him and basically forced him to agree to stop dragging his heels on a united front. But anyway, Joseph Stilwell was the U.S. general who had been assigned and deployed inside China to help sort of facilitate training, strategic deployments, things like that. He was supposed to help this united front army deploy inside China against the Japanese occupation and to continue receiving supplies over the Burma Road. He and Smedley, and I don't want to overplay how much influence she had here because I think she was just offering a perspective that he happened to agree with anyway. But they were in alignment on this point that the Chinese communists needed to receive arms through the Lend-Lease program, not just the nationalists, because, and this eventually led to Stilwell resigning, A, because he didn't get along with a lot of the other U.S. military officers, especially in the United States. But also B, because he kept on butting heads with Chiang Kai-shek over this, is that he was just adamant that they couldn't keep sitting on these weapons they were receiving from the United States and other supplies and they had to actually attack the Japanese. And Chiang Kai-shek didn't want to do that because he figured, well, the other allies will eventually take care of Japan, and then they'll have to leave China. And then we'll have all this gear sitting around that we can turn back on the communists when the United Front ends. And Stillwell wasn't very happy about that. So I thought that was an interesting thing that she did have this one of the very highest level U.S. generals was on her side and in alignment with her for at least a period of several years. One of the things that she and some of these other reporters who were allowed to be pretty openly pro-communist during the war, one of the things that they influenced was that they at least temporarily got the U.S. to kind of back off supporting the nationalists after the war, at that critical moment during the Chinese Civil War. And that is a factor in why the mainland war was won by the communists rather than there being a, you know, Korean War style intervention. I mean, there were a lot of reasons why that didn't happen. There wasn't a lot of appetite for that in the American public. But again, part of that is because there's just been a several year propaganda campaign to say, no, actually, the communists are our friends. And they're also trying to promote democracy over these, you know, corrupt militarists and so forth.
Yeah, this brings to mind when I was researching for the Frank Church episode. During this time, he was actually in China working for military intelligence, and he was actually pretty swayed by both the Indian independence movement and I think the Chinese communists as well, in their search for freedom, for getting these imperialist forces out of these countries. And so it really kind of shaped his view on as well on what the role of these movements were and how best to support them. So he was very sympathetic with both the Indian independence movements and I think the Chinese Communist Party. He wasn't super impressed with Chiang Kai-shek. I think he wrote several letters to that effect. So it's kind of interesting. Before he kind of joined the anti-communist viewpoint, he was actually pretty sympathetic to it during his time in World War II and shortly afterwards working in military intelligence. So that wraps up our episode on Agnes Smedley. As always, all the show notes are posted with the episode. And thank you for listening. And thank you, Bill, for joining me in the discussion.